All right. Good afternoon. Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome back to CSO2 and sort of my first lecture in this class. I'm Professor Campbell, if we haven't met. Agenda for today, so just real quick on logistics as kind of we get into the swing of the course. So labs are meeting this week. This week will be the Make lab, which you can view on the website. Additionally, we will have a quiz after Thursday's lecture, so be on the lookout for that. And then the assignments are sort of all posted, but certainly the one that's due first is warm-up. This, remember, is a sort of a C review. So if you're less comfortable with C pointers or expect to need a little bit more time to kind of get used to thinking about C pointers, be sure you're starting that one early. Now, okay, I know that everyone knows this, and I'm just kind of repeating the obvious here, but how do I know these things to put them on the slide? Well, it's from the course website. So the schedule page is probably the most important, right? Lists the topics, links to the readings, the links to the recordings will be included after class. Also links to the slides showing which quizzes are released, what labs, and then if we scroll down and see when the different homeworks are due. So again, I know you all know this, but just in case you haven't really looked at this, this is the main source of figuring out what's going on in this course. Okay, so last time we were talking about how do we create a program, right? How do we build it, compile it, link it, and then how do we use Make to automate that a little bit, to make our jobs a little bit easier. We'll talk about that real briefly, and then we'll move into to today's topic, which is, okay, we have this program. What can it do when it runs? And to talk about that, we have to get into how accounts work, users, groups, and we'll talk a little bit about sudo. Okay, let's see here. So remember last time, we had this example, we were building this software. And what's kind of nice is that the example makefile that we ended up sort of creating is actually pretty realistic. If you look at a project in the real world, it's gonna have a makefile that looks roughly like this. Now it might be, of course, a little bit longer, but the core elements are all here. So the key pieces, are the outputs on the left, right? So before the colon, that's what we're trying to build. And then on the right are specifying our inputs. So that's what has to go into that build process. So all of the functions that are listed after the tab are going to use those as inputs. Now, to simplify this, right, so we don't have to kind of copy and paste for every different C file we use these pattern operators to sort of match a wildcard, right? And that way we can build, kind of compile any C file into its corresponding object file. To make that work, we have to use Make's automatic variables, right? This lets us reference those inputs and outputs in the build command. Again, so we don't have to copy and paste, but also in the case of the generic C to object file, we really need some way to reference, like, well, what did that percent wildcard actually match to? And so we use Make's built-in variables for that. Now, we can have other variables, just kind of like any sort of a programming language-esque thing, right? And this just prevents us or means we don't have to keep copying and pasting the same arguments over and over again that we might want to pass to multiple commands. And then finally here at the bottom, we have a list of additional dependencies that go into building those object files. And it's really important in Make that we express all of these dependencies because that lets Make know, well, if this file changes, what do I have to do, right? What are all of the steps that I need to rebuild so that you get the correct program you desired? And what are all the steps I don't need to redo so we're not just wasting a bunch of time? Okay, good with this, right? So that's from last time. Now, this last bit here, for this simple example, I mean, it's pretty short, right? It's a couple header files. But again, you can imagine a more complicated C program would actually have quite a few header files. And so actually listing these out can be pretty difficult. But because make is an established, sort of long-lived tool, other programs know about it. So the compiler with the dash MM flag can actually output those rules for you. And then you can imagine sort of expanding the make file to run that command with the compiler on your behalf to generate the dependencies so that make knows what it needs to check for. In this class, we're probably not building complex enough software that that's quite necessary, but just so you're aware that that's an option. And over time, as with most things, right, make works great for some people, other people are like, this is completely unusable, and so we've had other programs and other programs that generate make files. So we can write a make file or we can use a different program to generate make files on our behalf. And so tools like CMake or AutoTools are examples of that. And then there's other build systems that are not like are not based on make at all. Ninja, Bazel, Maven, Xcode has a built-in one. And so these all fundamentally do the same thing, right? They track inputs, they generate and run commands to build outputs. They just have different syntax and are sort of tuned for different use cases. Okay, so that's kind of where we ended up with makefiles. Any questions on that? Yes?
Could you say a little bit more about wildcards and automatic variables?
I'm sure I can do that. So let's go back to that where that was highlighted here and here. So this was the example. So what's highlighted here are the wildcards for make. The key here is that we can take this will sort of match to any file that ends in .c. And then this match will then create what's over here. And so this is basically telling make we want to build an object file with the same root name, just a different extension. And so anywhere where we've asked for a .o file as an input, make knows, okay, well, this file doesn't exist, but I know how to build .o files. I look for the corresponding .c file, and then I run this, or basically I run any commands listed here, and that will generate the .o, which then I can use to keep going. And by having these pattern, the percent symbol, the pattern matching, we can do this for sort of any C file. So this works for extra.o, it also works for main.o, because it'll match to both. And essentially it's the same as if we just copy and pasted that. But we don't have to maintain many different copies of this. And then the matching are the automatic variables. So these are the ones that start with just $ and then they're like some character. And so this $ at means match whatever this output is. This is going to be match the sort of first input. And this is going to be match sort of all these inputs. So it's going to match all of this. And so in this way, we can substitute what we specify in the top line into our commands without having to copy and paste. And in fact, for this one, right, we wouldn't even know what to copy and paste here, right? Because it's a variable here, so we need a variable to match. Yeah?
Sorry. Can you use a wildcard in a variable, and what's the history of star in a set? Is there
a star? That's not here, right? Okay. This is just make syntax. So if you're familiar with using like an asterisk as a wildcard, the percent is kind of like that. And the variables, the wildcard we'll use here in the specifying the inputs and outputs, and then the $ variables will be in the build commands. All right. Okay. So now that we have a program, we want to be able to execute it. And kind of this question comes up of, well, what should this program be allowed to do? And so that's going to motivate our discussion about accounts. And as an example, consider this top function here, right? This open call. So you've probably written this line of code or something similar, right, to open a file, which then you could do something with. And here we're asking for, right, we're giving it a file name and then saying, I want to be able to read this file. Okay? All right, that's fine. That's perfectly useful thing for a program to do. But from a system point of view, is it okay if that runs? Like, should the program be able to access that file? Maybe, right? If I wrote this program and I'm running this program and this is my file because my account is Brad JC, then yeah, it's probably pretty reasonable that I can access my own file, right? But if you wrote a program and you called this function, maybe you shouldn't be able to just open that file for reading. So how can we restrict this? So the first thing we have to sort of understand is that this open function is actually a system call. And a system call is when our user space program that's running at the user level calls into the operating system or the kernel to ask it to do something on its behalf. So in this case, it's open a file. There's many other examples of these system calls. And now because we have the kernel to support that, the kernel can decide, hey, should this succeed or not? Like, should I allow this operation or should I reject it? We will go into the details of a system call in the next class or so, but for now, we just have to understand that this is something supported by the operating system. The contract between user space and the kernel is basically there's a known set of numbers that map to system calls. So like open has a particular number. When we call the system call with that number, then the kernel knows that we were trying to do an open call. Now when this happens, the execution mode goes from what's allowed in user space into a privileged mode in hardware so that the kernel has more control and more access on the system. Hence it can actually try to decide whether or not to grant this system call or not. Now, the kernel only knows about the system calls it knows about. User space can't just like invent its own. Those would just be an error. And the sort of trust and security is built on this idea that the kernel is going to be correct, right? It's going to do the right thing. And so if we're going to use that operating system on our machine, we sort of trust that, like in this open example, it will do the right thing, right? It will respect whatever policies we have for whether or not this process should be able to open this file or not. So, back to our question, should this open succeed? And my argument is that, well, we can't tell just from this call. We need something else. We need some additional metadata to be able to make that decision. So where do we get this additional metadata? Right? Should we maybe add additional arguments here? And so maybe, okay, I requested read-only. Should I also say, oh, you know, this read is okay? What's the issue with doing something like that? Yeah. Exactly. We're asking the thing which is deciding to open whether or not it's okay. Well, of course, the thing that's trying to open something is going to be like, yeah, this is totally fine. We can't ask or we can't let the process itself determine if something is granted or not. That really doesn't make any sense. Same kind of issue with, you know, where the code came from. Well, that might not be a proxy for anything that we care about in terms of restricting permissions. And again, it's kind of like asking, hey, do you think it's okay if you do this? That's really not the model we want. And so we need some other way to enforce this. And the first step is just to understand, well, who's asking? Right? Who's requesting this open call? And so to facilitate this, POSIX and Unix systems have this concept of a user ID. And each process, when it executes, is associated with a user ID. Generally, it's the user that started that process. Now, a process is essentially a program plus its state. So it's basically a running instance of that program. Of course, we're going to go into a lot more depth on that. But for now, we just have to understand that it's a program that's running. That's going to get assigned a user ID. Every process has one of these. And now we have sort of an identifier that the kernel can start to use to say, okay, should this be allowed? Because at least we know who's asking. As a program, right, and when we're running, we can call get effective UID. UID. Now, we say effective, we'll get into that detail, but basically it's get the identifier, the user identifier for this process. Now, the kernel, and this is the core part of the operating system that's going to be doing this permissions checking, it's really only focused on numbers. Like, it doesn't want to have to think about strings like Brad JC or whatever username. It's just going to use a number. Now, that number is going to be used for these permission checks, this user ID. And we can have somewhere else in the system. We can store a mapping from a more human-readable name, which is probably easier for us to use, to the actual user ID number that the kernel, well, frankly, it's easier to implement with just a number. And so a file like /etc/password can hold that information. If on more complicated systems where there's a whole network of machines, maybe we have a dedicated sort of database somewhere that does this mapping. Okay. So we have these user IDs. They're basically a number that identifies a user account on the machine. They get attached to the process. Any questions? Okay. So that's kind of this sort of direct mapping of just a user account, a little bit restrictive. And so to make this a little bit more of a general mechanism, we also have the idea of groups. And groups are kind of what the name implies, right? Ways to categorize multiple users into different groups. Groups also have an ID. It's just called the group ID. Same general idea. The kernel wants to use numbers. We often want to have names. And so we're going to have a mapping between the group name and the group ID. A process can access its group ID just like it did before, just like it did for the user ID, just with different system calls. A user can be in multiple groups, and a process can be running sort of associated with multiple groups. So same kind of idea, just a little bit more general. It's not directly mapping to specific users, just a way to group users maybe by into students or faculty or staff on the machine, different ways of organizing user accounts. Now, you can view which your user ID and group memberships are. Hopefully, there's a command called ID, which is just a built-in system command. It basically is just calling those same system calls we just showed, just provides a command line interface for it. I ran this. This is what I got. Right, on portal, right, tells me my user ID, my primary group ID, and then other groups that I'm associated with. Now, if you're wondering why there's sort of a primary group and then another list of groups, that's sort of a historical artifact. When this was first created, there was just a single group, That was too restrictive, so they added additional groups, but then for backwards compatibility, they kind of left this notion that there's a primary group ID. Okay. Good so far? Any questions? Okay, we can also have groups that aren't necessarily connected with kind of the properties of the users themselves, but maybe express kind of access control or sort of use the ways they should be able to use the system. So for example, consider something like video. And any sort of process which is associated with the group video would have access to the monitor. And so if something, if a user is interacting with the machine directly, then their processes would have this association, and if they were SSH, they wouldn't. Right? So we can use this for additional mechanisms like that, but this is is not perfect, because we might be interacting but then log out, but leave the process running, and so this isn't a perfect system, but it's another way we can use this notion of groups. Okay. So, our question was, should that open call succeed? We can't answer that yet, but we're making progress. So now with these user IDs and group IDs, we have a way to establish identity. Right? We know who's asking. Or at least we have a way to represent who's asking. But that's not enough. We also need to know, but does that user have permissions? Right? Just because now I know that I'm the user that's running this process and that's requesting it, but should I have access? And so we need to have some mechanism for expressing these permissions. And the primary way we do this in POSIX is through file permissions. And so you can think of this as sort of a part of the file system, but it's there to express this idea of permissions at sort of a per file level. Now, up front, this is a very limited interface. It doesn't give us a lot of ways to express and creatively come up with permissions, but it's kind of at that sweet spot where it's simple, but it works for a lot of use cases, and things like that tend to last. And so we still use this today. Okay, so how does this mechanism work? Well, it's based around three primary permissions. That's these read, write, and execute. So this is basically what you're allowed to do. Can you read the file, can you write the file, or could you actually execute the file as a program? We define those permissions for three different categories of users. So we have the user for the group, and if that doesn't match for everyone else. And so what this way this works out is basically each file is going to be associated with a user ID. We typically would consider this the owner of the file, right? So if you're logged in and you create a file, by default, your user ID is going to be associated as the user ID with that file. Essentially, you own that file. Now, for that, we get those three permission bits. So you can have read or not, you can have write permissions or not, and you can have execute permissions or not. And then you can also change the permissions. Okay, so that's the user, or sort of the owner. We additionally have a group. And so we have to record the group ID that's associated with the file. And this is for any user that's in that group, but is not the owner, will have Again, read permission or not, write permission or not, or execute permission or not. Now, if you're a user and you're not the owner and you're not in that group that's associated with that file, then you sort of fall back to this last category, the default, the other. Again, same set of permissions, read, write, or execute for kind of everyone else. This applies for both files and directories, although there's not really, it doesn't really mean anything to execute a directory. And so instead that's mapped to a search operation on that directory. Questions? Yeah. How does a file get the group ID? So the user ID is pretty straightforward. It's like, okay, the user maybe created that file. The group ID is going to be set to whatever that primary group ID that the user is associated with. So it's kind of like your default group, you might think of it that way, is going to get sort of set by default. Other questions? Yeah. Is there a maximum number? I'm going to hopefully answer your question, but expand it a little bit. So is there a maximum number of users and groups you can set per file? And the answer is yes, it's one. So in this model, you get one user ID per file and one group ID per file. And then, well, how many users and groups can you have on a machine? Like, what's your sort of pool to choose from? That's sort of arbitrarily big. I mean, up to the data structure size you're using to store the user IDs and group IDs. So if you had, say, 32 bits for user ID, well, that would kind of cap how many users you could enumerate. So that's kind of the absolute limit, but functionally, we generally don't have that many users or groups. Yeah, question. Is the owner the only person that can change permissions? Sort of. We can also kind of, we have, we'll get to this in a bit, but we can have sort of all permissions, and that user can also change things. So sort of like an administrator, you might think of. Yeah. Okay, yeah, so so we have these sort of three categories, right? If you own the file, if you're in the group that's associated with the file, and then there's this default. And that's kind of the fallback for everyone else. So if you have a user account on the system, and you try to access the file, but you didn't create that file or you're not the owner, whatever the group ID is, you're not in, then that's when you fall back to the default settings. So you're sort of constrained by whatever permissions are set there as kind of for everyone else. Yeah?
I'm a little confused what it means to be associated with the group, like the file being associated with the group.
Okay, so what does it mean for a file to be sort of associated with a group? Essentially, that's just going to mean, so if we have some file, let's say we have this file. In the file system, we're going to store additional metadata. So we're going to store the user ID and the group ID with the file, its name, where it is in the actual storage. And then, of course, we're also actually going to store these permissions as well. So we're going to have permissions is stored in there as well. And so basically, it's sort of that mapping. Okay. All right. So given this, how many bits or what data structure do we need to store these permissions? So we're going to need the user ID, the group ID, and then these permissions. How much space do we need? Yeah. It'd be a bit field. Okay. How big of a bit field? 9, right? We need 9 bits. We've got 3 permissions, 3 categories, 3 times 3 is 9. And so to encode these permissions, basically we need a 9-bit number. And the typical way we represent this, and Bill write this out, is an octal. So basically we're going to have 3 digits. We'll see examples. The 3 digits correspond to those 3 different categories. So the first digit is for the user, the second digit is for the group, and the third digit is for other. Now, we have 3 permissions, and that's 3 bits. So we need, so we're going to have 3 bits to store that, and we're going to encode those permission bits as basically a binary number in this order. And so our read is going to be the fourth bit, or sorry, the equivalent to the 4. So the bit here, write is going to be the bit here, and execute will be the bit, the lowest bit here. Okay, so it helps, I think, to see an example. So imagine the sort of permissions encoding 700 or 700. The 7, right, comes first, so that's going to correspond to the user. Now it's a 7, and so that in binary is 0B111. 1 means that we have the permission, so that means we have a permission set for read, a permission set for write, and the permission for execute. Now, group is going to be the second digit here. That's 0. Well, okay, so that's pretty easy, right? Binary 0 is just 3 zeros, so we have no permissions. And then the same for the other, this last digit here, binary 000. Slightly different example, 451. So again, same logic here. First digit corresponds to the user. Now in binary, a 4 is 0B100. So that means that we have the read permission, but not write or execute. The group is a 5. That's, we'll go over here, 0B101. Meaning we have read, don't have write, but we have execute. And then finally this 1 here in binary 0B001. So not read, not write, but execute. So hopefully you can kind of see how that maps. I'm not going to try to claim that this is like overly intuitive, but you can kind of see how it's efficient. It's pretty space efficient. And if you do like an ls command with the dash l flag, you'll see this additional state here where it's actually showing you the permissions. And oftentimes you'll see permissions sort of written in this syntax here with this octal notation, like the 700 and 451. Any questions? Yeah.
So for 421, you have the user reading and the group reading and executing. Does that mean the user can execute within the group that was executed?
So how do these permissions map if you're the owner, so you're the user ID, but you're also in the group, but those have different permissions? This is definitely something we should try out, but I believe that you match what you match. So if you're the owner, you match those permissions. If you're not the owner and you're in the group, you match those permissions and then fall on. So you don't just get the best of whatever's there. You get whatever you match first. Yeah.
Where's all this actually stored? Like what user owns it and stuff?
It's here. So where is all of this metadata stored? So it... traditionally, this lives in the file system. So we're not going into the details of how file systems work, but essentially the same structure that's giving us directories and encoding where files are stored and the names of files are also including this metadata. Yeah? Is this scheme used in most operating systems? It's used in most Unix systems. Windows is always a bit different. But this is sort of a very common scheme. Okay. All right, so now we have a way to represent these permissions. How do we actually control the permissions? So there's a tool, chmod, which allows us to actually configure these. Here's a couple examples. These examples were setting exact permissions, meaning we want to say, okay, here's the entire set of permissions we want for this file. And so we use this command, we specify the file name here. And so if we wanted to set those permissions 700, we would do it like this. So we would call chmod with the permissions and then the file name. And this is saying, I want to assign these permissions. And so this is great. An alternative does the exact same thing, is we can set it with the sort of flags as letters. So again, we specify the file. Here we're saying we want the user to have exactly read, write, execute. Other and group are having exactly nothing. So no permissions. Same exact thing, just different ways of expressing it. Some, I think, just kind of personal preference whether you want to think of it in sort of the encoded format or kind of a letter permission by permission format. Same exact thing with our 451 example, right? We can set the permission to a file, or we can break it out. User gets exactly read, group gets exactly read and execute, other gets exactly execute for the particular file. Yeah? Okay. So let's go back to this one here. So chmod, we're setting the user permissions to read, write, execute. And then we're saying, okay, we also want to set the O permissions, the G permissions to equals, and what's important here is there's a space. And so this is going to get separated when this function runs. This is going to get basically returned as nothing. So equals, you know, there's nothing here, right? So there's just nothing there. And so that's going to be no permissions. And then the next argument is file, right? That's kind of separate. And just says, this is the file we want to express that on. Yeah?
Do you always have to set all three, or can you just set the user?
In this example, we're setting the exact permissions. So if we go to the next slide here, we can adjust permissions as well. And so if we don't want to change, we don't want to set all the permissions, we can just change what we care about. So here, again, same command, chmod. Still, we specify the file name as the second argument. But the first argument, now we're using a plus sign. So still user adding the read permission and the write permission. Or sorry, read permission and the execute permission. Now, if it already had write, it will still have write. Right? And then the other group and other are not modified. Yeah. So what happens if you add spaces, say, in this string?
Yeah,
I don't actually know. I think you can't. Charles, do you know? Okay, yeah, so this is one argument without spaces.
Okay, gotcha.
And it will start treating anything you have after the space as another file. Yeah.
Can you just adjust the permissions if you've never explicitly set them before? Like, is there a default?
So what happens at sort of the beginning? Is there a default permission? And the answer is yes. Right. So there has to be some permission that your operating system is going to set when that file was created. And then you're modifying from there. Yeah?
Can you do like an add or the same line? So like O minus markup plus X?
Question is, can you add and remove at the same time? The answer is yes, right? You can use this syntax to add permissions to sort of one category, remove from others, and set the third if you want. Sure. In general, these old commands like chmod kind of assume that you're an expert, and they kind of basically want to provide a simple interface for you to do exactly what you want. So generally, there's a lot of flexibility like that. Okay. All right, so this is the most common example of this sort of interface with permissions. But as I mentioned, it is a bit restrictive because each file only gets associated with one user and one group. It doesn't necessarily allow us to do a lot of fine-grained access control. And so there are other models. And so for example, you can have a sort of longer access control list. And it's more flexible, lets you sort of control things on a more fine-grained basis. And essentially what this means is that you get a list. So instead of just having those two categories or three categories, you can sort of have a list of permissions that you want to enforce on any given file. And different file systems support this. So like NTFS file system supports this, for example. There is a version for POSIX, but it's not widely used. Because again, while sometimes features are nice, they come with complexity. And that complexity isn't always necessary. We've kind of found that the simple example does tend to work for a lot of use cases. But just to kind of show you what this would look like. So here's a longer version. So you'd have kind of these list of different permissions. Pound sign is just a comment. But so here we can say, okay, for this group of students, it gets this permission, right? And for this file, if you're in group faculty, you get this permission. Now, if you happen to be this user, you get this permission. And if you're this user, you get sort of no permission. So you can see how that, by being able to list these as separate things, we can do sort of much more fine-grained customization of permissions. Sometimes this complexity is worth it, but generally speaking, systems use the simpler version. Yep?
Does this ACL syntax something that you'd see on your normal Unix-like system, or
is this particular syntax something you would see on your normal Unix system, or is this something more specific? So I would say on your normal, like you installed Ubuntu on your laptop, you're not going to see this. But if you're running something, maybe like you're running a whole campus of machines, you might want to be able to have much, this more sophisticated restrictions. Yeah. Okay, and we'll see this in an upcoming lab. We can also, again, sort of just like the chmod, we can adjust these permissions using get and set fackle. And so, again, basically same kind of idea. We're modifying the permissions for a particular file with different settings. Similar kind of idea. All right. So where are we at? We've talked about identity. So we know who's trying to do something. We now have a way to encode permissions. And so this is sort of our policy, right? And those are two pretty important ingredients to our original question is, should that open command succeed or not? And the last piece here is basically the enforcement piece. So, okay, now that we know who's trying to call open, we know what the permissions are for whatever they're trying to open, should that actually succeed or not? And that's where the kernel comes into play, right? So when the open system call runs, the kernel is going to do its check to say, well, hey, are these permissions valid? Right? Does the permissions this user have allow this command to run or not? And so if so, great, I'll do it. If not, well, I'm going to return an error. And so this is what that system call handler on the kernel side is going to do. We really have to delegate this to the trusted part. So the kernel is going to be our trusted sort of operating system manager that we're delegating to say, we assume you're implemented correctly. I'm comfortable running you on my machine, and you're going to enforce these permissions I've specified for all these files so that if someone else runs a program on this machine, I know that those permissions will be respected. And so that could be sort of opening the files like our running example with open. That could also be using signals and communicating with other processes, which we will, again, another thing we'll get into as the semester goes. All right. So far, so good? Okay. So what about, So what about exceptions, right? What about cases where, you know, this is all well and good for a lot of times, but sometimes we need to kind of subvert this system, right? I need to be able to access a system level file, or I need to install something into a system level location. I need to manage the system, not just kind of be an end user. To facilitate that, we have a capability in these systems called super user. And we typically reserve user ID 0 for this. And this is also called root or administrator or system. And this basically grants additional privileges that a typical user ID and a typical process would not have. Right, so all these permission checks we've been talking about would generally not apply to something running as super user. Okay. Now, as the name implies, right, this is still a user level thing. So we want to make sure we're separating this from the kernel. So we have user mode. Usually we think of that as on top. That runs in sort of an unprivileged state in the hardware. And then we have the kernel kind of below that. And that runs in a privileged mode. And it can do more things. Now, if we're super user, we're still running in user space. But when we request operations or resources or we do those system calls into the kernel, the kernel is going to treat that a little bit differently and maybe would permit things that it otherwise would reject. And so the kernel mode running sort of in a privileged state in hardware kind of maps to super user sort of like running a privileged operation on top of the OS. And so that's kind of the separation there. So we're not kind of running... A super user thing is not running inside the kernel. It's still user level, just with additional permissions. And that lets us do things like implement login. So we need some way for you to sort of access the machine. Right now, this could be sort of via a remote connection, or you're sitting down at a machine terminal and directly physically interfacing with it. We want something where, right, we can give it a username, we can give it a password, and it can decide, should you be able to access this machine or not, right? And so in here, the example, right, the answer was yes, and then you could run a command like ls. Okay, whatever. So what does it have to do, right? What does this program login have to do to make this possible? Well, first, it needs to check if the password was valid. So you give the program a username and a password, it's going to look at something stored on that machine to determine if that was actually accepted or not. And we're trusting that this program is implemented correctly and it will do this reliably and the way we expect. Those passwords have to be stored somewhere. We typically store them in an additional file, often called /etc/shadow. And then we use those same file permissions we've been talking about to restrict who can actually access this file. Because this really should only be accessed by that super user or root user, not just anybody. So this is the typical case. It doesn't have to just be in a file, right? We can also implement this as over the network, as sort of a database stored somewhere. Again, much easier to manage if you have thousands of machines spread across multiple buildings or something. You really don't want to have to be updating a file on every individual machine. And so, but essentially, we just need some way to match an acceptable password with the user. Now, I'm saying password, but that's not that's not sort of integral to this. Really, we just need something that you know that would be secret. And nowadays, we use a lot of different methods for authorizing, right? So, and smartphones really push this forward. We can use Face ID or fingerprint or a PIN code or password or something else that's secret to just us that the system can check. And if we know that or if we have that, then we should be allowed access. So, login, now it's going to check that the password was correct. Once it's determined that, yes, okay, this is in fact a user that should be allowed to log into this machine, now we want to actually give it sort of a shell, give the user a shell, something they can interact with. The first step is we don't want the process that we're going to spawn, the shell, to run as the same user as the login program. We want it to run as the user that's trying to log in. So the way we implement this is the login will switch to the user ID of the user that's logging in, then go ahead and run this, and then it will run the shell. And to actually do that change, we can use the set UID system call. And so basically, if we have permission to do this, we go ahead and we'll actually, we can change the effective user ID that the program's running with. Now, this is important because the login program, right, that really has to be a trusted, it has to be able to access that password file. That's a pretty special program. That's going to have to run as super user, but we don't want everything else that the user runs to run as super user. And so here we can actually, the login program will restrict its access by changing its ID, then spawn the shell, and then go back. And so that effective user ID is sort of that temporary one. But then we also, the kernel will save the metadata so that login can switch back so that another user could log in later. Okay. And so here we change user ID, and then once we do that, we can spawn the shell, and now your shell will run as your account with your access permissions. Yep. So why do we have to change the, you know, why do we have to do this step? Well, the key is what we really want to do is we want to do this. We really just want to run a shell that the user can now use. So they're okay to log in, let's give them a shell. But when we spawn that shell, that shell needs to run, that's a program, it needs to run with a user ID. By default, it's going to, or the system is just going to copy whatever user ID of the program that spawned the new one. If we don't change the user ID, this shell will run as the same user as login, which is super user. And so now this shell would sort of have like full administrative access, which is not what we want. And so by changing the user ID to the user that logged in, then spawning, now the shell will have the user ID that logged in, and then the login program can go back to its original super user ID so that a future login can succeed the same way. Once you're in the shell, can you switch back to root? Good question. Yes. Maybe. Yes, maybe. So, if we're running as our user, but now suddenly we need to do one of these administrative actions, can we kind of go back? Like, can we get back to super user sort of mode, if you will? And there's generally a program called sudo that lets us do exactly that. And so we would typically run this, or we would run this as the sudo program, and then whatever command we wanted after that. And the syntax here is that we want to run whatever this other command is as superuser. And so the sudo program is very, very important because it's what allows, it's sort of a special, it's still a user space program, but sort of a special user space program that allows us to do this switch. Now, we don't just want anybody to do this. Because again, we've been talking about these permissions, and we want to have these checks. If we just let anybody just become super user, well, they could just bypass all these permissions. And so that's why we have to check for a password or something, right? We need some way to make sure that whoever's running sudo is allowed to. If that succeeds, the sudo program will then run whatever commands you ask for it with those super user permissions. Okay. So that's kind of our way to get this privileged mode. But there's something like still not quite right here, which is why does the system let this happen? Because recall, right, so when the shell ran this sudo command, generally speaking, whatever program the shell starts inherits the shell's user ID. And we said the shell is running as our user ID when we logged in. And so sudo should run as our user ID. But then when it tries to do this privileged activity, the kernel is going to be like, no, you can't do that. And we can't just, and so one way around this is like, well, I'll just set my user ID to 0, which would be convenient if it worked. But of course, we can't just allow that, right? Again, we can't just allow, this is like back to our question about should we allow the open command to just say, oh, yeah, it's fine, right? Oh, it's fine. I can be root. We can't trust the program to do that correctly. So you can't just do this. So how do we allow sudo to run with the privilege, sort of in the privilege level of superuser, even though the shell is not superuser? So this is kind of a, basically we kind of hit a dead end, and so we need a new mechanism for this. And so this is this set user ID sort of property that we also have. And so this is an additional metadata bit alongside those permissions metadata that we've been talking about. And essentially what this does is this says, if this bit is set, when this program, for a particular program, an executable, when it starts, it shouldn't inherit the user ID of what started it. It will inherit the user ID of the owner. And so this is kind of that last missing piece that we need. So sudo, when it starts running, won't be running as the user ID of the shell that we logged in, you know, our user ID, basically. Instead, it's going to run with the user ID of the owner in the file system. Now, that owner, conveniently, is going to be 0 or root. Right? And so when sudo starts running, it will have these super user permissions. So sudo is owned by root. It's also got this bit set. And what that means is that when this starts running, it will be user ID equals 0. just kind of to complete the story here, right? So chmod, we can also set this bit. That's what this is for, so how we can configure this. And inside of the sort of whatever this program is, so sudo in this case, inside of a program that's marked set user ID, it can still do things like check, like, hey, was the original user that I would have been had I not had this bit set? Does that user have permissions? And so it's still a program. It can make those decisions based on how it should be implemented. So it can still check the original user's permissions and decide to error. And so it doesn't necessarily grant every possible access or permission. It can still be restricted. Okay. So that's how we can have a non-privileged or sort of non-super user start a program which actually runs a super user. Any questions? Yeah.
How do programs that need to run in kernel mode fit into the system, like a driver or something? Is there like a similar thing that elevates the system that level?
How do other types of programs that need to run sort of in some sort of privileged way work? For example, a kernel driver. Does that kind of work like this? And so we're just talking about user-level programs right now. So something like a kernel driver that actually exists within the kernel is going to be separate from this. And so the kernel will have some other mechanism for loading those if it can load different kernel modules. They may just be already included with the kernel as kind of one compiled binary. But this is separate from that. This is just looking at user space. What else? What other questions? Yeah. Good question. Okay. So where is this useful? So we've talked about the main one, which is the sudo use case, because we really don't have a great way of doing that otherwise, or we don't have a way of doing that. Some other examples of cases where we want something to run, and we don't really want it to run with the permissions of the user that's logged in. So like mounting a USB drive. So mounting that file system is a sort of privileged operation. We don't just want any user to be able to do, but to be able to use that flash drive when you plug it in, we need to be able to mount it. So that's an example. Or other sort of IO operations, talking to other peripherals. We may want the programs that can do that to have specifically access to their peripheral. Or maybe talking to a secure log file, where we want to be able to use that file, but not anything can read or write it, but a particular process that needs to use that special log file can have access to it. Another example here, and we'll definitely talk about ports a lot when we get to the networking section of the class, but port numbers are sort of broken down where the smaller numbers, the ones that are sort of easier for us to remember, are sort of restricted. And so if you have a program that needs to use one of those lower numbers, it would also benefit from this to be able to run in a certain mode, which would give it access to those lower port numbers. So those are some kind of examples of sort of potential use cases where this kind of set user ID functionality is useful. What else? What other questions? Are you okay with this? Does there some part of you that's like, I mean, I guess I get it, but like, is this really work? Like, is this actually okay? You just have these programs where they start running and then they suddenly have super user permissions? So maybe for some of you, kind of like, you get this little bit of uneasiness of like, yeah, I'm still trying to get my head wrapped around it, but I guess it kind of makes sense. But also, like, that seems like there could be, you know, that seems like it could be problematic. And so this is kind of this intuition that you start to develop as you think about sort of the contract between user space and kernel space and these low-level permission controls, is that sometimes we need to have certain mechanisms so we can actually run the systems we want to run that are usable. But they kind of like, ooh, if we do this, we better really make sure we get this right. Because this could have some really serious consequences if we get it wrong. And this is definitely one of the sort of examples in that kind of case where programs that are expected to run this way are difficult to write because you really don't want to mess anything up. Because whatever that program does, the kernel is basically just going to trust because it's super user. And that's sort of the contract. And so a lot of things that maybe as when we're writing sort of normal programs, we kind of have this safety blanket, right? Like there's an operating system. The operating system will kind of keep bad things from happening in a lot of cases, right? If we really mess up and we use memory we shouldn't, well, we get a segmentation fault. And yeah, that kind of sucks and it's annoying to debug, but hey, at least we didn't crash the system. Right? At least no one's calling us and saying, hey, why doesn't Portal work anymore? But when we cross over into these super user things, now suddenly that sort of protection is not quite the same anymore. And so if things maybe aren't the way we assume they are, so like standard in is closed, or signals, which we will talk about, are set up in a way we don't normally think of them being, or maybe the arguments passed to main are not quite the way we think they are, generally speaking. So on and so forth, right? These things that we might take for granted, we have to be really paranoid about. Because maybe there's something that's trying to start our program that's trying to sort of mess things up for us so that if there is a bug, well, that maybe becomes a security vulnerability and that system is compromised. And so as you kind of write more code in this space and learn more about these low-level operations, you'll sort of be refining your intuition to say, I think this is important, but this is very subtle. This is going to be hard to get right. And we need to really make sure we're doing it properly, right? And that, you know, that's going to take time. We're going to be really diligent about it. We're going to write very careful code because, right, if we get this wrong, you know, things could go very badly, right? And if you're writing software and building systems that you actually want people to use, which is generally the point, right, and is going to be, you know, deployed, if there's like issues like this, that could be sort of very catastrophic. And so this kind of leads into a general class of vulnerabilities or issues called privilege escalation, where some flaw in the program allows, or the program or another program or the kernel allows a process to run at a higher privilege level than it should have had. So things like buffer overflows can lead to this. Other sort of failures or faults without the sort of proper safeguards can lead to these types of failures. And then suddenly now you're able to get access to things you shouldn't have gotten access to, which can be obviously pretty problematic for a system that's, you know, supporting multiple users and running important operations. And so these kind of really core programs, right? They really need to be, robust, and that those system call handlers, right, really need to be correct, and so that these issues can't be exploited. Yeah.
How specifically does super user bypass the complex? You said like how it can affect memory in ways that regular users
Yeah, so what is sort of super user doing that allows it this extra control or this extra access? It pretty much boils down to these system call implementations. And so, I mean, this is like an extreme simplification, but once that system call is handled on the kernel side, I mean, there's essentially going to be a check. If superuser, or if UID is equal to zero. And if that's true, then the kernel's going to be like, okay, I'm going to permit this, right? Whereas otherwise it would, and if that's not true, then it's going to go through and like say, look at those permissions or something. Yeah. So how do set user ID programs handle bugs? But I think your question is sort of like, what if we do set up the system this way, but then we don't quite get it right? What happens? And that's actually a fairly complicated question. If we have a certain specification, we have a certain way something should operate, we then tell application developers, like, hey, if you want to write a program that runs on my system, here's what you do. And they go out and do it. And then later you find out and you're like, ooh, shouldn't have done that. That's a tricky problem. Because now you've got all this existing code, which might work just fine and is bug-free and is perfectly good. But we figure out there's something wrong. And so that's a challenging sort of space to try to figure out what the right thing to do. Generally speaking, we don't want vulnerabilities. And so we have to think about fixing those, patching those, removing whatever the mistake was. Good system design, we try to architect things in a way that we can make those changes and hopefully still permit legacy applications. This is why there aren't a lot of operating systems, right? There's a couple, because they're really hard to get right. And it takes a lot of time. And you don't want to be wrong. And so generally speaking, most people don't want to invest a bunch of time trying to make an operating system correct. Other questions? All right, thanks everyone. Be sure to attend the lab tomorrow, and we'll continue on Thursday.